Way down in Missouri, where I heard this melody when I was a little fellow on my mammy's knee, the old folks.
Welcome to Show Me Missouri, the history of Missouri. Normally one county at a time, but today it's going to be one family at a time. We are here in Columbia, Missouri, at an Orsland farm and home, speaking to the man that runs the name and the stores that you've seen all over the state of Missouri, Mr. Barry Orsland. Thank you for joining us here on Show Me Missouri.
Good morning, Scott.
It's such an interesting story. I, like everybody else in the state, have been in your stores 100 times. But it is interesting when I started to look at the history of it. Your family's made an impact on this state, and it's in a very diverse way. I guess it's a very Missouri way of going about things. And so I appreciate you joining us to kind of talk about the history of your family, your history, and maybe a little bit about the business here on the show.
Okay. Where would you like to start?
Let's start with your beginning. Where'd you grow up at? And tell me a little about the family and where you go to church and that sort of thing.
Well, I grew up in Moberly, which is about 30 miles north of here.
Yep.
Currently live in Columbia. But I still have office in Moberly, and I'm adding a second office here in Columbia for myself. So family originated in Tipton, Missouri. Yep. So my great-grandfather, I guess, migrated from Germany to Tipton, and then my grandfather and his four brothers were kind of a clan, and they were farmers there, and in the late 20s, they decided to migrate to northern Missouri, where the grass was greener, so they ended up finding a piece of property in Sturgeon, Missouri, and they continued their farming operation, and during the course of that, they thought, boy, maybe we can make some money on the weekends. So they hired big bands. They built a dance hall, actually, called Orsland Heights.
Right.
Yep, Orsland Heights.
Now, you've, as I think a lot of folks in the state know of you, some folks know about you. That tradition of music is something you've kind of kept in your life, right?
That's right, yep.
So now in high school, there in Moberly?
Yep.
Well, what's the Moberly high school mascot? I can't remember. We did our Randolph County show a while back. When you're in Moberly, when you go from high school, where do you go to college at?
I went to college at Central Methodist in Fayette, Missouri. And the reason I did is because I played in a rock and roll band starting at age 12.
What's the name of that band?
And
that
was called Plato and the Philosophers. And I played pretty much with the same guys for over 40 years.
Did you do covers? Did you write your own? Or?
We wrote our own to some extent, but mostly covers.
Now
nobody really wanted to hear the songs we wrote.
Now about what years are we talking there?
When I was 12 years old, so 1962 is when I started.
So that would have been pre-Beatles maybe, right?
Just right at that time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Coming up. So you go send. What would you study at Fayette?
I majored in economics and business administration in Fayette, and the reason I went there is because all the rest of the band members went to Central Methodist, and so if I went to another Catholic college, it would break up the band, and God forbid that would occur.
Well, you got to have priorities,
right? My dad didn't really understand that, but you're right. You have to have
well,
priorities.
Well, looks like it worked out for you. Tell me about your family and your wife.
So my wife and I have a total of 9 children between us, and she's originally from Chicago, and she's
not a Cubs fan.
She's very much a Cubs fan.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah.
You and Governor Keogh have a tough cross to bear.
And so all my kids are grown now, and I have 14 grandchildren.
Well, congratulations.
Yep.
Talk about your family. So bad in the early 20s, they started this Orsland Heights dance hall as a way to make extra money. There is a history of your family, as I'm reading it, that talks about how you all always were starting new businesses and trying new things and tinkering with stuff. That's an interesting and a very Missouri trait to have. The part I thought was super interesting was after a few years of having the dance hall, you come up with a way to get people there.
Right.
Now, tell me the story how they started a trucking company out of basically like an Uber for Orsland Heights Dance Hall.
So the idea was that the main difficulty in getting your crowd to attend your events was transportation. And so they convinced a banker to loan them some money to buy a used school bus. And they used that bus to go around the county and pick people up before the dance and then take them home afterwards. But in northern Missouri, I don't know if they knew it or not, but there's only about 3 months of decent weather for outside dances. So the rest of the year, they used that same school bus to go around and haul freight from one grocery store to the next, or whoever needed something dropped off in another town, they'd call the Orslin brothers and they'd come pick it up and deliver it.
Well, now I read where the jukebox came in, kind of put a dent in the dance hall business, but they bought a few more buses by this time, and they still had an ability to turn that into an entire trucking company.
Right.
I mean, that is an amazingly nimble business move to go from a dance hall to a trucking company. But I guess that when technology happens, you got to respond, right?
Well, you do. And remember, this occurred over time, quite a period of time. And the truck line was a very successful business for many, many years. And most of the family worked there. That was kind of it was almost an unwritten rule that if your last name started with an O, you had to work for the truck line. The second generation took a different approach. And they said, what we'd rather you do is don't come work for us. We don't really want family members working in the organization. We want to run it like a public company.
A corporation.
And shareholders can get their benefit of ownership through dividends or whatever. But we'd prefer that you go out on your own and you become successful. And then we might call you and ask you to come back, but probably we won't.
Well, let's talk about, I skipped a little bit. How did your family come over here from Germany? Is it?
You know, I really don't know. I'm sure it wasn't a plane. So
yeah. I had a boat involved somewhere, right?
It was a boat or a canoe or something. There had to be some way to get here.
I read where in part of this is you go over and the Orslin family invented a type of parking brake, correct?
Right.
That they needed in trucks. I mean, okay, that is so another intervention in the company, right?
So that came about because when they had the trucking business, one of the uncles was the chief mechanic. Obviously, he was in Orslin, so he got a job there. And he invented the over-the-center parking brake lever that you'll see on almost every UPS, FedEx, Clark forklift, ground equipment for airlines in the world, all over the world. So
did you get a patent on that? Or?
We did. We did get it. He got a patent on that. And that business started in 1942, I believe. But it was a very small business, and it grew. And today we literally have operations all over the world and manufacturing not just parking brake systems, but cables and shifters and, you know, just a variety of driver controls equipment.
Well, it started here in Missouri. Obviously,
started here in Missouri.
Inventing something to help their business grow, that ended up helping all kinds of businesses grow.
Right.
So it's read here where at some point in the 60s, all the brothers, you said that clan of brothers decided they was going to split up the company and kind of have people go their different ways. And then W.C. Orslin decided to start a farm supply company. And that's the name that Missourians, they might not realize that overhand break is an Orslin family invention, but everybody knows the stores. Tell me about the first store and how that, what's the family story on how they decided to divvy everything up?
Well, there's really two issues there. First of all, with regard to divvying things up, there were a total of five brothers. W.C. was my grandfather. And so, again, most everybody worked there. So four of the brothers and their families thought, boy, they'd like to keep the truck line. Mm-hmm. And then my grandfather and his two sons, Don and Jerry, said, well, we'll take, there was one farm store, I believe. There was an International Harvester dealership. And then there was the beginning, very small, embryonic parking brake business. And so they branched off and they took those three items, and then they've, you know, were successful in growing them. And fortunately, I haven't destroyed it yet.
So they took the parking brake portion and grew it to what it is today.
Right.
And then I guess during the time, it was, as I read it, W.C. Orslin's son started in 1960. That's in Sedalia, right?
Well, it was an existing hardware store, and mm-hmm. I can't recall the name of it, and I can't recall, I don't think I ever knew why he bought it. I think it was just something that was for sale, and he thought, man, I need a hardware store in Sedalia, Missouri, but that's what he did, and then they leveraged that one store and grew it to whatever it is, 180 stores today.
So when they start that one store in Sedalia, I think most folks, if you haven't, I've been there because the state fair comes to Sedalia once a year, obviously, and it's a kind of a go-to place to pick up what you need. But it did grow pretty quick. Now, at the, are they still running the parking brake business while they're expanding the stores? Because it says he brought in his son Jerry to run the store in Sedalia, and he really took off. Was he doing the parking brake business as well, or how did that, how'd they divvy up that work?
Jerry Orslin concentrated on the farm and home business. Mm-hmm. That was his niche. Even though Don and Jerry were partners, 50-50 partners, Jerry spent his time during the day growing the farm store business. My father, Don, was responsible for kind of for everything else, which included manufacturing. They also had a vending company called Doji Vending, and they had a chain of laundromats, and, you know, they did lots of stuff. They were both entrepreneurs, and I think the thing about entrepreneurs is, that makes them successful is they're not afraid to fail.
Yep.
And they failed a lot.
Isn't that a good Missouri story, though, that you have the guts to go out there and plant your flag? You know mm-hmm. what I mean? That is something I think that's unique to Midwesterners, that they'll go out and try things like that, you know, such as inventing an overhand brake. That's a, that is something that, that I actually had heard, but I didn't know the full story about. So let's talk about you. You go to college. You come out. What do you do after college?
Well, I was told I couldn't come back home and go to work. So I started interviewing and got a job.
How does that conversation go?
It was not bad.
I
knew that I wasn't going to be able to come back right away without an invitation. So I just started interviewing after I got my diploma, and I went to work for Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. Mm-hmm. And I started as a claims adjuster. And I really liked that business. I liked the opportunity to negotiate. And my supervisor happened to have a heart attack like a year after I started. And so he was out of action. So they said, Barry, you've done a pretty good job so far. Would you mind taking over the supervisor's desk? And even though I'm not sure I was very qualified for that, I did. And I apparently did a pretty good job. So anyway, I stayed in the insurance business for 5 or 6 years, and then had the opportunity to come back, and I started a insurance agency in Moberly called Third Century Insurance, and so that was just a general all around property casualty insurance agency. And at the same time, in 1977, I started a leasing company, mm-hmm. and that was called Third Century Leasing. And we leased a variety of pieces of equipment, from starting with trucks.
Oh, by chance, old school buses to haul people to dance halls?
We probably did, but I don't remember that. But we started leasing trucks and so on, but we specialized in what we called small-ticket leasing. And small-ticket leasing are things like copiers, computers, mm-hmm. telephone systems. And eventually, I sold that business to Chase Manhattan Bank, and I went to work for Chase as part of the deal, commuting back and forth to New York.
Well, that's where I kind of want to take a break, and we'll come back about when Mr. Orslin came to Orslin. Mm-hmm. But one of the, always before we take a break, I want to thank our sponsors. We're always very grateful to the Missouri Farm Bureau for letting us come to places like Orslin Farm and Home today and talk to some leading Missourians who made the state what it is, the Missouri Association of Counties and Missouri Association of Electric Co-ops. We'll be right back here on Show Me Missouri, the history of Missouri, one county and person at a time.
We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for home sweet home. We're for condos, tutors, single wides, and studios. We're for ranches, houseboats, two stories or 20. Red cedar, bluebirds, white squirrels, black walnuts, whatever's out your back door, we're for that. We're for watching the sun rise over the Mississippi and set over the Missouri. We're for kicking off your heels in a high-rise or hanging up your hat in the boot heel. And if you have a home in Missouri, we have a policy for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we've got Missouri covered.
Welcome back to Showing Missouri, the history of Missouri, one county at a time. It's kind of a special edition this week. We are actually not we're getting to be in the back room of the Orsland Farm and Home here in Columbia, Missouri, with Barry Orsland, the man that runs the Orsland Farm and Home store that's all over the state of Missouri. I know you've been in one. Next time you're in one, think about this show, and we're going to learn a little bit about the business and the strategies going forward from the man himself, Barry Orsland. Thank you for staying with us.
Glad to be here.
So you sold this leasing company, this business, to Chase Manhattan. That's probably a complicated sale. Of course, they want you to stay on for the transfer, mm-hmm. I guess. Mm-hmm. So you have to go from Moberly to New York to commute?
Right. Well, Chase in New York also had a small ticket leasing operation. So my responsibility was to oversee the leasing operation we just sold them in Moberly, as well as their New York small ticket leasing operation. But one thing that was really that's important to this story is that I hired a guy from Baltimore. His name's Bob Parsons. And Bob really was an inspiration to me. Even though we were about the same age, he was a really smart guy. He had a tough childhood, but Bob was brilliant, and he was really the guy who put together our systems for leasing, and it's really what made us so successful with our customers is because we could give a credit answer in a matter of hours to our customers as opposed to days.
Yeah.
And Bob, after we sold the business to Chase, went on into the software business and eventually started GoDaddy.com, wow. which is his business today.
That's an amazing story.
He's done very well for himself.
You probably watch it. If you're listening to this online on a website, you're listening to from a GoDaddy website that you had hired early on in his career, huh?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still keep in touch with him?
Or? I sure do. I talked to him just this last week. He's also in the golf club business. He manufactures golf clubs called PXG.
So I
told him I needed a new driver, and he had one in the mail to me the next day.
Good to have a friend like that.
Yes.
So you do a commute. So I guess you just had to drive to St. Louis or Kansas City, right, and fly out every week?
That's right.
Well, I bet that gets old, don't it?
It did. Boy. And so it lasted for a couple of years, and then I had the opportunity to come back into Orsland with my finance background in mm-hmm. not only college but working for Chase. And I came back in as chief financial officer.
How's that conversation go?
Good. I mean, it was. I had several opportunities at that time. I could have gone to another leasing operation or another bank. I had an opportunity to work for Bank One. And anyway, I wanted to come home, mm-hmm. and so I took that opportunity. And I was chief financial officer until 1990, and that's when I became chief executive officer.
So up to that time, it had grown from that store in Sedalia to about 85 stores?
I can't tell you by that time. It was around 60 or so stores yeah. when I took over.
And now you're grown to 175, is that right?
That's right, and we're in 10 states.
What state you in?
All the states surrounding Missouri, and we go as far west as western Kansas and Nebraska, as far east as Ohio, as far south as Texas, and as far north as, I guess, Iowa.
Yeah. So you come in to take over the company. How big was the company? What was the revenues when you came in?
Probably in the neighborhood of $75 million at the time.
In 1990, right?
Oh, yeah, in 1990, yeah. Right.
So when you go to take over, what's that? I mean, I would say that most people don't know the story of the Orsland family with all the other businesses and how this came to be. They would know the highly publicized brand name of Orsland Farm and Home, but it's still that's a very proud family's name that the whole state knows. I guess that's kind of it's not like coming in and taking over a business that you don't have. It's not like when they bought that first hardware store in Sedalia. Mm-hmm. They probably bought that from a family proprietor. That was his family name. You're coming in taking something that's your family name. I guess there's a special trust there with that.
Yeah. I suppose there is. It's not something I really think about much. It's all because right. When you're born that way, yeah. you don't think why certain things happen. But
so tell me, when you go to just begin to grow like you have, that's got to be a thought out strategy. Is that something you do because you want to buy the ground? You have opportunities. There's a market hole. What makes you decide? Okay, we're going to take this and more than double the size of the company.
Well, that's not an easy question to answer because we're so diversified. One strategy in manufacturing for expanding might be and is different than expanding on the retail side. Mm-hmm. So on retail, you know, we're always looking for acquisitions because that's the fastest way to add, you know, new territory and existing stores. It's much more expensive to do them one at a time. You know, and we are doing some of that, but that we like to wait for acquisitions and buy a group of stores at a mm-hmm. time if we can. On the manufacturing side, because we're all over the world, you have to find places that are friendly to manufacturing, like India, for example. That's been an excellent place for us to do business. Europe, and we have a plant north of London, and that's an outstanding area with great people. And
so today you run not just the Orson we all know, you still run the company that started with that Overhand Brake.
That's correct. Right. We still have that business.
So I guess how much of your day is spent on that global company as opposed to Orson?
Well, my brother Bob spends his day running the manufacturing side today. Mm-hmm. Bob's background is in manufacturing, and he also is an entrepreneur, and he started a company called OrbSeal over in Carrollton and mm-hmm. Richmond, Missouri. And he had plants all over the world, too, that made sealants and adhesives for automotive, Ford being his biggest customer. And back in the 90s, we sold that business to Henkel, and Brother Bob went to work for Henkel as part of the deal. And then when his time requirement there was over, he came back to Orsland and took over the top manufacturing job, which is what he still does today.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting thing. I would venture to say most people listening to this do not know about that global business in India and England right. and things that you oversee. Back to the farm and home business. I bet you, to me, it looked like when you came to where Poplar Bluff, where I'm from, that was just a one-off. There was nothing there, and Orsland came in, and now I've noticed in Jefferson City, Poplar Bluff, and a couple other places, as some of the bigger box stores, Kmart's the one that comes to mind because what I've seen, you've went from an existing location that may be smaller to a much bigger place
right.
because some of the other bigger boxes haven't been able to compete.
Right. And, you know, I think you'll continue to see more of that. You know, retail's been a difficult business the last 15 mm-hmm. or 20 years, or maybe forever, but certainly the last 15 or 20 years. And so you've seen companies like Sears,
yep.
Gander Mountain, Kmart, all go by the wayside. And so
you're in the business. Why have they struggled and you've grown?
You know, I'm not really sure. I think because we tried to do our best to satisfy our customers, you know, so it's not yeah. just about, you know, it's not just about important things like technology and so on, product selection, but it's, you know, trying to read your customers and find out what it is that they really need in a given area and taking care of that need.
When I was doing research for this, I was talking to a couple people, and I was like, well, Orsland is a new niche. And I'm like, you know what? I remember the old True Value back in the day in Poplar Bluff that had, obviously, products are different now, things are different, but that was a similar store. There's been stores of a similar concept in the past. It just looks like you found a way to make some brand loyalty and to kind of stick out and stick right. it out in the market during tough times, I guess.
Right. And, you know, we've always sold pet food, and we've always sold feed, and we've always sold top-line clothing like Carhartt. So, you know, none of that's new.
I can tell you firsthand, you sell grapevine supplies.
Great. You know? Good. You've heard that through the yep. grapevine, right?
That's exactly right.
Oh, good.
So a couple other things. I've seen that you were on the board of UMB Bank.
Was, yes.
That's something that I think people maybe not think about, but a lot of businessmen throughout, especially rural Missouri, will be on those bank boards.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that's a time commitment, but what makes you decide to put that commitment in, and what do you get from that? And if you're a person listening to this and that obviously you would love to emulate something like a career you've had, what makes you decide, okay, of the time I have that I'm going to dedicate part of that to that bank board?
Well, I've pretty much always sold, I've always served on a bank board. It was United Missouri at one time, and today it's Citizens Bank and Trust over in Kansas City. But the reason I do is because you can learn so much from a bank board meeting in terms of what's a quality credit. What is it banks are looking for? What are the things that they don't like? You know, it helps you run your own business because, after all, unless you're independently wealthy, we all need banks.
Give me something. If you're a young person out there and you've got a small business and you want to grow it, and the only way, like you said, do it is with a bank. Give me the way. What if you're on a bank board? What are some things you look for, and what are some things you're afraid of when you see?
Well, when you're on a bank board and you're looking at a credit, you're obviously leery of anything that's brand new without experience. Mm-hmm. You like to make loans to people who've been around for a while and who've been through hard times and so on. Obviously, you want people that stand up to their past commitments. So if you find somebody, hasn't been making their house payment or their car payment or whatever, that's probably not going to be a good candidate to make a loan to. But the other thing about banking is it tells you about the market itself. You know, it lets you know, in general, are ag loans good today with the crop prices, at the level they are at? Or are they maybe not a great bet in this economy? If you recall 10 or 12 years ago, real estate was a very, very difficult business for the bankers, and they owned a lot of real estate, or they ended up owning a lot. They had a lot of customers who defaulted on real estate deals. And, just being involved in that process and being involved in working out those bad loans was a great experience for me.
So tell me about your team, the people that you have on the farm and home side. Walk me through who you have in the top positions and what you look for in those people.
Well, Mark Johnson is the top person at Farm and Home. And Mark has spent his whole life in the farm store arena he's worked for three different companies in the farm store business, including our largest competitor, Tractor Supply. And Mark's just a great family man. He's a great merchant, and he's wonderful with people. And that's kind of what I look for, you know. Somebody who doesn't have such a high ego that he's not a fun person to work for, and Mark is. He's a great guy.
Who else you have on that top team?
Oh, I have many, many people on the top team. You know, at Farm and Home, we have great IT people.
Yeah.
That are just the
How big a part of things is that becoming for you?
Oh, it's huge. And I know how huge it is because our email system went down 2 days ago or 3 days ago, and I honestly thought the world was coming to an end. And 20 years ago, you'd have said, "What's email?"
Yeah, call somebody. Tell me about I'm sure that a lot of people listening to this are familiar with their own Orscheln Farm and Home, but when you have a manager there, when somebody comes in and manages a store, what's the process to manage a store in the Orscheln Farm and Home chain?
Well, being a farm store manager or in retail or retail in general is a tough business. There's long hours, but I think it's rewarding because you're helping people all day long. You're helping people and you're helping them solve a problem, helping them fill a need that they have at home. But, you know, we're looking for people, obviously, with experience, first and foremost, people that have a great track record and, you know, in terms of paying their bills. I mean, there are folks that live up to the commitments they've made throughout their life.
Sometimes people don't understand that. But so even if you're going to hire somebody to manage a store, you look at their credit and their history.
Sure. We look at that person as a whole, and we get references, and we check the references. Mm-hmm. And we hope a drug-free environment. So, you know, we do drug testing to make sure the people we hire are clean and sober. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want. So
tell me about you've spent some of your time serving the state. First time I recognized your name personally outside of the company was when you were on the Highway Commission.
Right.
What made you decide to sign up for that?
Well, Governor Carnahan at the time was a friend, and he asked me if I would be willing to serve on the Highway Commission, and quite frankly, at the time, I didn't even know what the Highway Commission did. I assumed they had something to do with highways. So I didn't know anything, but it didn't take long to figure out that it was a great organization, MoDOT. They've just, you know, they've done so much with so little. If you think about the gas tax has been pretty stagnant for for a long time now. Mm-hmm. And you know, and so they're when I served on the commission, I think we had about $1.5 billion that we could use for, you know, building new roads and maintaining our existing roads. And today it's a third of that.
Yeah.
And the reason is because, you know, we spent a lot of it already for future needs through bonding, but our income at MoDOT, or the income of MoDOT, simply hasn't kept pace mm-hmm. with the amount of highways that they have to take care of.
You came to the Highway Commission at a really tough time for MoDOT. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the 15-year plan,
right.
And I believe when you came on, they had just announced that they weren't going to be able to meet the commitments they'd made. That had to be... I mean, I would assume morale was tough there at the time, and that was a challenging environment, to say the least.
That's an understatement, yeah. I think what we did was we felt it's important to tell people that the 15-year plan was not realistic.
Yeah.
It was not realistic to build a four-lane road to every single town of 4,000 people or more. And I think that, you know, I wasn't around when that commitment was made, but we felt, at least under our watch, we were going to tell our customers, the public in Missouri, exactly what we can do, and just hope that, you know, that they'll understand that we're going to prioritize based on needs and not based on a plan that was. That they came up with overnight 15 years earlier.
I remember at that time, obviously, MoDOT was in a rough way. And I think when people today, when you describe MoDOT from then, if you weren't paying attention then, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, MoDOT has, I think, one of the better run departments in the state. I mean,
right.
Now it's not, I think that used to be an argument every time people would talk about funding transportation, well, MoDOT will waste the money. Now it's that do people want to have the money? I don't think you hear a MoDOT incompetence argument at all. And while that's been the case for a long time now, that took a major turnaround from about, I would say, 2000 to probably the late part of the last decade. It took a long time to live that down, but they have.
They have. And it's always been a well-run organization as far as I know. And I've known a lot of the people who've served on it in the past. And, you know, they're all class people. But the thing is, We don't have some of the tools other states have, like tolling.
Yeah.
You know, I personally believe toll roads is the way to go because it's the ultimate user tax. The people that don't use the roads don't have to pay for it. The people that do should pay for it. The problem is everybody's in favor of a toll road as long as it's in somebody else's part of the state.
I'll tell you, that one at the lake is probably the greatest example of a toll road I've ever seen.
Yep.
Anybody that thinks that bridge there at the lake is a bad idea is just they're not a serious person.
That's right.
To me, that's like the anybody that talks about toll roads, I can't imagine a better example than that toll road.
Right. And so now we have I-70 that's, you know, they're holding together with glue and toothpaste. I don't know what all, and it's way too busy. It was not built to be. It's over 50 years old now.
Well, and
I think it was built to be 20-year road at the time.
They have a speed limit of 70 on that, but you can't go 70 hardly ever. The traffic is too thick.
Right.
You know, when anytime there's a wreck, it just backs up. But it's an interesting thing where infrastructure, people want to pass that along to the next guy, or they want to do it. We have such a big and diverse state. I think people want to, well, you fix your needs, but have the whole state fix my needs.
Right.
And it is a complex thing, but I think it's probably one of the most important things that folks do. You also have just taken on a new challenge.
Yes.
Going on the Conservation Commission. It's an interesting thing. You know, a lot of folks in rural Missouri were the ones that didn't get their highway built in the 15-year plan. That was a challenging PR thing that overcame. You know, you've won some rural folks that aren't as big a fans of conservation.
Mm-hmm.
interesting thing, and you have a farm and home store, so everybody knows your name. It probably was a good pick. Why did you decide to sign up for it?
Well, I think that it's a great organization. I think that it's always been a great organization. I think it's ranked close or at the top of all conservation agencies in the entire country. And it's because they run a tight ship. They've got great people that work there. And
there's also some of the argument they have a dedicated funding source.
They do have. That's
right. I think that makes
a
difference.
That's very, very important.
It's so funny. I mean, I've always been a Republican myself. And it is funny that people have a concept. I guess I'm more of a capitalist anymore than even just a Republican. If you put money into something and you're funding it at a reasonable level, you should expect a reasonable result. But if you're not funding something, you shouldn't expect a result like you are. And I think conservation has been good stewards of what they have, but I think it's always interesting. There's a reason why conservation has the ability to succeed mm-hmm. at the levels they do. It's because they have the money to.
That's exactly right.
You know, they also could right. have that money and not succeed at that level. But I always thought it was interesting with MODOT. You expect them to do these things without the funds. If you were here and you had a store manager and you squeezed his ability to do things or promote or do anything, and his revenue was poor, it shouldn't be a shock. But somehow you take that concept of government and people just don't get it.
Right.
I've always found the Republican three-step of waste, fraud, and abuse. I can always tell a person who's either being political or just aren't a serious person when they start breaking that out because, you know, it's an interesting thing. And conservation has taken their advantage and done a lot with it. And I think it's a source of pride for the state.
Yep.
You know.
And today, you know, conservation has some real challenges with chronic wasting disease in deer and then with the feral hog.
I have a feeling you got asked about that when you were getting confirmed, that chronic wasting disease.
I did, but I didn't have an answer because I didn't know what it was.
That probably helped. I'll give you, I think that generally conservation is thought favorably by Missourians. I've always felt like it was interesting to me how city business leaders would also pitch in and back conservation when it came to it. Chronic waste disease is the one thing I've seen. Now, nobody likes to see the conservation agent and get a poaching ticket or whatever. You know, you're going to have that. But most folks know they're doing something wrong when they're poaching to start with. So you kind of, you know, you don't hear too much of that anymore. But the chronic wasting disease has been a debate of does it exist? Is it bad? Can you have these, I don't know what you'd call them, vacation places where you go shoot a deer? Since you've been on there, what is your opinion? I'm sure you've heard both sides about chronic wasting disease now. Can you look somebody in rural Missouri in the eye and say this is a real problem they should be worried about?
Well, just to clarify, I've attended one meeting so far since I've been on conservation.
Do you have to keep Mr. Bedell in line at the meeting?
So, you know, he does a good job keeping himself in line. He's
and
terrific.
A few others usually.
He's terrific.
I think he's Mr. Conservation at this point.
Let me just say, so I don't pretend to know all sides to that question yet on chronic wasting. Is it real? Absolutely. Absolutely it's real. And, you know, they keep great number statistics, mm-hmm. where they're finding chronic wasting around the state, how often, in what quantities in each county. And so, yeah, it's very much real. And is it a huge problem like Wisconsin today in Missouri? No, it's not. But we want to keep it that
way. Wisconsin has a big problem with chronic wasting disease?
Approximately 50% of the deer have it.
Now, when they have it, that mean you can't eat them, or when they die?
I don't want to eat one with chronic wasting, but I don't know how they taste when they have that. But the thing is that eventually, I think it is ultimately a fatal disease, but it spreads as a problem. You know, it goes, and they don't know for sure if it goes beyond just deer. There's some concerns that it might transfer to elk and other types of animals like that, but just the fact that it's here and that it is growing should cause us, you know, to be very concerned about that.
So when you decide to sign up for something like that, that does take some time.
Yep.
How do you make that decision? You're running a business. You're running one that you got to think about India and England, and you also have to think about Poplar Bluff and Jefferson City and Sedalia. How do you decide as a business person you're going to dedicate the time you have to something like that?
I think it's like anything else, you know, if you've been blessed, if you've gotten, if you've had some success, you have the obligation, in my opinion, to give back to your local community, to your state, mm-hmm. and to be involved. And yeah. if there weren't people that would do that, then you know, it'd be pretty tough place to live.
After the governor's first nominee did not get confirmed, I thought it was particularly important he picked somebody that, that would. And I think most folks thought you would be. And that giving back, when you're on a conservation commission or a MoDOT, what can you actually, what are some things you can do to get back, other than just try to give it a good sounding board and good advice to the staff?
Well, first of all, you have to rely on your staff, so you better make sure you have good ones. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, they do.
Tell me about the conservation staff that you've met. I know just one meeting. But
well, Sarah Pauley is a terrific manager. She came from DNR. She has a journalism degree. She's a lawyer, and you know, she knows how the state runs. She knows the political side of things, and she has done an amazing job of building high quality and retaining high quality people to work for her, to work in conservation. And that's the key to anything, whether you're in the farm store business, conservation, or building highways, mm-hmm. is to have as good a team as you could possibly get.
So a couple questions I wanted to ask you. You've obviously been very successful in business. I'm sure folks would think you've done this your whole life, but your time out doing other things and coming back in or coming into your family business, what's an advice to a young entrepreneur you'd have that's maybe sharpening that business plan for a pitch to a bank next week? What's a piece of advice you'd give that person starting a business career?
Well, I'd say, first of all, don't be afraid to make a mistake. You know, yeah. The only people that don't make mistakes are people that either don't do anything or they're dead. So, you know, you're going to make mistakes. We all make mistakes in our family life, in our personal life, and certainly in our business life. That's just part of life. The key is to get over it and put your head to the grindstone and just try it again. Try some, you know, you have to be a realist about anything you do. You know, you have to know when, you know, your idea or your business or whatever it is isn't working, mm-hmm. and you need to, you know, get out of it as cheaply as you can and start anew. You know, in my case, when people ask me what I do, I tell them I have two jobs. I'm a fireman and I'm a cheerleader. And I prefer being a cheerleader because I want people to know that I'm involved and that I support them. And, you know, you want to give the people that are your stars the biggest pats on the back. And the people that aren't stars, well, maybe you need to get more stars.
Yeah. Last question I want to ask is, your name is all over this state on buildings and newspapers and promotion on the radio. You know this state probably as well or better than anybody. If you had somebody that come in from out of state, where would you take him in Missouri? What would you have him see, and what would you have him know about the folks that live here in Missouri?
Oh, gosh, there's a long list of places I'd take him, but Branson is the first place that comes to mind. You know, you know, what Johnny Morris has done in Branson is just absolutely amazing. He's first class in everything he builds. You look at Silver Dollar City and the Hershen family.
Yeah,
that's another outstanding success story. People who really want to make the state a better place. And both of those organizations are actually, very much involved politically. I don't mean from Democrat, Republican, but, you know, Peter's involved in the higher education, and Johnny Morris is involved in so many different things, it's hard to count.
Yeah, but, mind-boggling.
They're giving back. You know, they've realized a lot of success, and now they want to use their talents to help our state.
Well, Mr. Wilson, I want to thank you for the time. I appreciate the history of your family, of the stores, and of yourself, and the advice you might have passed along to some other folks. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
I just want to thank our sponsors, the Missouri Association of Counties, Missouri Association of Electric Co-ops, and Missouri Farm Bureau for letting us come and bring you the story of families like Mr. Barry Wershlin's and tell you the history of Missouri, one county at a time. We'll see you next week on Show Me Missouri.